Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Yes, yes, and isn't that what we need more of in this world? Love and peace and justice. So you are at the right place. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And, you know, this is the time that I remind you, because if it's not in the headlines, sometimes it is out of our consciousness. There's still genocide going on in Gaza. We are still at war with Iran. The excursion is now up to 100 days at about $2 to $5 billion a day. So that's our tax money. Always remember that. And there is no end in sight, y'all. Why is there no end in sight? Because this administration went into war with no strategy, except that he's a big bully and he thought that would go over. But lo and behold, here we are. In wars, nobody wins. I don't really believe nobody wins, because there's deaths and casualties and lots of damage that gets done. But we are at a military disadvantage now. That's what happens when you don't have a strategy when you go into war. So now the Iranians have the Strait of Hormuz that is putting the chokehold on all of the oil coming and going. That was not figured into this whole little excursion, as the so-called president would say. But it is causing havoc, not just in this country, but around the world. The world markets are just shattering and shaking based on what's going on. And these billionaires don't understand the price of oil and what oil does to an economy. There's lots of things that depend on oil, deliveries, airplanes. So everything's going up, y'all. Inflation's up. So we as working class people will feel the brunt at that pump when we go at the grocery store. But these folks got people shopping for them and fixing their food and driving their cars for them. So they don't understand this impact, but we do. And so that's why we need to tell our Congress people, put a stop to this war. This is not how we want our money spent. But the other thing, y'all, when I think about all the things that are coming out now about the war, including the bets that are being placed on the wars. So just like they got all this betting going on with sports, they now have it with war. So you can place a bet on whether or not Iran is going to strike, you know, Saudi Arabia. You can place bets. So these people are making money hand over fist to our demise, and they are making plenty of money. So we don't want war in our name, and we particularly don't want an unjust war. But the Trumps are making billions off of war right now. And so and speaking of this man, many are saying that he's the reason why the Knicks lost. Now I don't believe in superstition, but I am an energy person, and he brought bad energy. He really did. And so the Knicks players and fans are pissed. And some of them are speaking out publicly, and some of them very eloquently. But, you know, it's always going to be about him. So he doesn't even care about what disadvantage or what inconvenience he's put people at. So that's what you have to know about a sociopath and a narcissistic. And remember, this man is a 34-count felon in the White House, giving directions to folks, us, giving directions to the military. But he also is a guardian of the pedophiles, because we still cannot get to the Epstein files and get resolution for that, and look how long that's been dragging on. So I want us to stay woke. That's important. Don't be afraid of that word. We got to stay woke, and we got to pay attention to what's going on in our name with our tax dollars and the harm that it's doing and what's being taken out of us. And that even means in St. Louis, you know, we're in the rage of a budget. And the police department wants to bankrupt the city budget, even though it wants to be under state control. It wants city money. And they want more money, more money, more money, even to the detriment of other city agencies and city services. And so there's been a number of budget hearings. There was one yesterday, packed room, lots of people testifying. And what immediately came to mind as you watched the testimony is that there is a showdown between race, class. And so the folks who were promoting downtown, getting some of that Rams money, were all about backing the corporations and folks who got to be downtown and the tourists and developers. And then the other folks who were mainly Black or advocating for Northside were saying, here's where the money needs to be spent. And so we're going to see very shortly, because we got to have a conclusion to all of this by the end of this month. That's when the new budget kicks in, is July 1. And so don't be afraid. Don't hesitate to call, email your alder people to say, you know, we want the Rams money to go to the continued renovation and rebuilding of the north side based on the tornado. So I'm giving you assignments because that's what I do, y'all. And if we don't have those assignments, if we're not being proactive, that gives them the momentum, that gives them the advantage, and we don't want them to have that, because we've seen what they've done already, right? For the last year, this man has wreaked havoc and suffering and pain on us in this country. He's got to go. Nobody wants to invoke Amendment 25, but he is unfit and unworthy of that position. So having said all that, I'm going to welcome my guest today, because this is an issue that I've had a long time interest in, and I know a lot of people have, particularly if you have folks who lived in the South. But yeah, we have today Renato Carr, who's a historian and lecturer at the Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. And he's been doing a lot, taking a really deep dive in lynching, particularly the case of James Edward Person. Now, I don't know, and we got some questions, and I got questions, and some of you all have sent me questions, you know, some Black people, some white people, so we're going to get to those too. But this is the issue that I told Renato is not like past. This is present, 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 present. So it's not going anywhere, because we still got lynchings going on in different forms. But I want to welcome Renato to the show. Welcome to Voices from the Battlefield.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I guess one of the questions I'm going to ask you is, I have the guest for this year, based on the fact that this is the 250th anniversary of this country, and the trajectory of terrorism against Black bodies from the time that we, you know, even before we stepped on these shores. What should people of African descent, how should they be looking at that anniversary? You know, what do we need to be thinking about as we project forward?
Well, that's a great question. That's a great question. And what I think about is, what do you do as a people when you are under assault? We are under massive assault, an assault that I didn't think I would see during my lifetime. You know, and to a large degree, people of African descent have always been under assault. But this assault is different. So for me, what I'm going to do to, I wouldn't say celebrate, but I'm doing a vigil in East St. Louis that is going to commemorate the 1917 East St. Louis race riot. So I would like to see all people of African descent get together and celebrate Black agency, Black resistance. It can either be through a parade, a walk, a vigil like one we're having in East St. Louis, and just kind of push back on this narrative that the United States is a democracy. It's been a land of freedom. And we know those words are aspirations. You know, it represents something the United States has never been. So for me, I like to see people of African descent, you know, get together and join a vigil or walk, some type of group organization that is going to celebrate Black resistance, Black agency, something that Black folks have done throughout our time in the United States. But it's a lot of things you can talk about.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it, because it's not so much celebrating the US history, is celebrating our resistance based on what we've endured here. And that's a different way of looking at it, I do believe. Because I think most of the time people want you to wave the flag and be, quote, patriotic. But really, there's not been much reason for us to be patriotic to this country because we've shed many blood, sweat, and tears, and look where we are. And so I think the assault that you're talking about politically, socially, culturally is unprecedented. I know I hear people say that too, Renato, that we've been here, this is always the case. No, this is a bit different. And I think if we don't recognize the moment, then we're gonna face a doom that we've not endured before. But yeah, I'm gonna think about the celebratory nature of that for us in our endurance, our resilience, our power. So yeah, that's a good one.
That's a
Yeah.
okay. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the first, and not to
Okay.
cut you off, but one of the first things I'm going to do is read Frederick Douglass' 1852 speech to what to the slave is the 4th of July. Love that speech, but I'm going to read that.
Okay, that's a powerful one. That's I do it sometimes too. I didn't do it last year. I might do it this year, but yeah, I'm trying to remember when July 4th falls. But yeah, I think we have to remember that because it helps us put in perspective where we are, as opposed to, as you said, aspirational. Because I think, it does help to be aspirational. It does help to have hope. Because if you don't have that, you're gonna have a hard row ahead. But yeah, I think, yeah, that's a good piece to remind people of our existence here in the United Snakes of America. So I'm gonna, this research that you've been doing, when I saw the name James Edward Person, there's a big family of persons in St. Louis. Are they related to this person anyway? So a Tim Person, Mike Person, all the persons that are out there, they're business people, which made me think about, the person family in Illinois. This the dad was like, he wasn't no poor person. He had some land and he had a business. So the folks that I know here, the persons, they also are business people. And like, maybe there's some connection there.
You know what? I don't know. I've met with the person family. They have not, shared with me if they'd have any
Okay.
family outside
Okay.
of Tennessee. But you never know.
Okay.
You never know.
Yeah, because of the way we were scattered, we really don't know who we are related to. So I think the name, the title of the research paper that you have, Come As You Are, Hood's Not Required, the 1942 Lynching of James Edward Person, I think really says it all. Because oftentimes, and I've written about this and I've talked about this, that the racists who might do the lynching don't always have hoods. And we now know that a bunch of them are in law enforcement. And so they've done some studies around that. The Oath Keeper recruits from law enforcement agencies. And so it's hard, that sort of melting of the two entities is I think has always been the case. But modern day lynchings are not necessarily folks coming with hoods, but they have, they're doing the same thing. They, mutilating, killing, assaulting black bodies. So first of all, tell us how you came to this topic, and then in particular, the James Edward Person lynching, because I can see why this is intriguing. And of course, for me, almost all of them there are, because there's a story to each one. But this one is in 1942, which it's a little bit different from sort of in the 1800s, 1900s. And so people are thinking by then, all of that's a done deal. And then the fact that he was in a up north, so there's some features here that I think would make it interesting. So what drew you to the story of James Edward Person?
Well, what I want to do was write something on the free bridge that connects East St. Louis to St. Louis. It was later named the MacArthur Bridge. Specifically, African Americans ran across the free bridge in 1917 trying to escape the East St. Louis race riot. So I want to do something on these black people running across this bridge. My great grandfather was one of those black people who ran across the free bridge to St. Louis. Caught the went to Union Station and took the first train back to Starkville, Mississippi. I've never read anything about that. I've heard about these black people running across this free bridge. So I wanted to write on that. Couldn't find anything on that, except one small little article. But what I did find, I was at the East St. Louis Public Library. What I did find was an article that says Negro lynched near Paris, Illinois. And it caught my attention because I had heard of Paris, Illinois. I went to undergrad at the University of Illinois, which is in Champaign. And Champaign is about 80 miles from Paris. So that caught my attention immediately. But I was still looking for something on these black people running across this free bridge. Went back down to East St. Louis Public Library the following week, and I found a second article on James Person. So at that point, I felt like it was calling me, and I dropped the little that I had on the free bridge and dedicated what turned out to be the next 6 years of researching James Person's lynching.
So, Renato, let me stop you there because I'm surprised that you haven't didn't find anything about that coming of the bridge, because I've had people on the show whose families were descendant of the folks who came across the bridge. And one of them, it was elected official Terry Kennedy in St. Louis. He was on the board of alders, and him and his twin brother often led the march back across in a symbolic ceremony. And I just can't believe that there was nothing about that in the archives or Googled or whatever.
Yeah, well,
Okay.
I would say it was nothing in the East St. Louis Public Library in the microfilm. It might be some stuff out there. I just didn't, I didn't find anything. So it may take some more researching. And I only spent maybe 2 months researching it. But within those, first 2 weeks is when I found the article on James Person. So I felt like, it was calling me. I never heard of this lynching. It happened in the North. It happened in 1942, and it was a federal case. So all of that got me interested in studying this.
So what did you find out about James Person? Because he was an interesting character from the standpoint of, and I guess because I'm doing a number of projects now around mental health and healing, it seemed like his mental illness might have been post-traumatic stress. And then, of course, they called it like persecution syndrome or something. But so to me, it could have been that, or it could have been schizophrenia, because he was a young man when this was started coming to the fore. But his story, in concert with the family that he came from, because I'm thinking when I read that his father put out a notice in two different locations, that to me in itself was very unusual, that at that time people had the wherewithal to do a missing persons, notice. And
Yes.
again, when I saw that his father, they had land, they had a thriving business, so he wasn't like poor. And he was very concerned about his son, who had served in the military. So talk a little bit about who James Person was, and then about his family.
Yeah, it's a lot to it, but James Person was born 1909 in Fayette County, Tennessee, which is maybe 45 miles from Memphis. In Fayette County, Tennessee, has a horrible racial history. In fact, black people could not even vote in Fayette County, Tennessee until around 1968, something called Tent City. You guys can look that up. But he was born there, small town. His father, Christopher Columbus Person, was a minister, educator, owned land. Very unusual. 90% of black people in Fayette County, Tennessee during this time were sharecroppers. James Person had three siblings, and his mother was named Topsy Person. Anyway, he gets drafted, United States Army. And like most black people who were drafted during that time, he did not go overseas, did not have any combat. He went to two military bases in the Deep South. Now, he's from the Upper South. He went to two military bases, Fort Benning in Georgia and Camp Alexandria in Louisiana. In fact, Camp Alexandria had a riot, and I can't determine if he was there during that time, but they had a race, it's called a race riot. It wasn't really a race riot, it was anti-black violence. The town people did not like these black men coming in town with their military uniforms on. So, and I say all that just to say that you mentioned the mental health piece. I can't prove this, so it's pure speculation. But I believe that James Pershing may have had a mental breakdown when he was at these military bases down south. One way black people have been able to resist, hold at arm's length white supremacy is through the community, family, and religion. He's not with his family. He's not with community. He might have some other black, troops, I mean, service members down there, but he's not in the confines of his family. And I think he had a breakdown. All that white supremacy down there, highly segregated military bases, one in which had a riot when he was possibly down there. So he serves 11 months, gets honorably discharged, and comes back home. His family knows that he's acting strange, very, very weird. He would hide behind the curtains with cars to come down the road, and he told his mother and father, "I need to go to Chicago to blend in. People are trying to kill me." The family calls the family doctor. His parents call a family doctor, John Morris, a white doctor, went to Vanderbilt Medical School, and he diagnoses James Pershing with this persecution complex, which I've never heard of. I've been searching, researching that term
Yeah,
for
I had never heard of that either, Renato.
never heard of it. I've been researching that term for 6 years. The DSM has never acknowledged that term. It's not an
No.
official mental health diagnosis. But basically, what it comes down to is that you think that somebody's trying to kill you. It's a fear, and it could be PTSD. I don't know. But it got me thinking about, the mental toll that racism has on black people. It takes a mental toll. But anyway, we don't know what happened. White doctor diagnoses with this. They try to get him to the VA hospital, Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And if you know anything about the VA hospital, during that time, very segregated. For whatever reason, they can't get him in. Okay, he jumps a freight train, which is a common way of travel during that time. He jumps a freight train in Jackson, Tennessee, which is where his aunt lived, his mother's sister. And for whatever reason, don't know why, and I know all this because I got the FBI report. It took me 3 years to get the FBI report from National Archives in College Park, Maryland. But for whatever reason, he is either thrown off that freight train in Libertyville, Indiana, or deboards on his own, maybe being confused. I don't know. But now he's in Libertyville, Indiana, which is a rural Vigo County, Indiana, all white, forming community. And what James Pershing does is very interesting. He starts going door to door to these homes, all white area, asking for food and water. And he's going to the back door, which is very significant because that is what he would do in the rural South. It wasn't uncommon in the rural South for black people to go to white homes, ask for food and water, as long as you do this, I call it this Jim Crow dance, where you have to go to the back doors and, not make eye contact and kind of slide a
All
little
that,
bit. Yeah, all that, got to go through this. So he's doing what he would do in the South, in the rural South. But that does not work in a rural Midwest because what happens is white folks go into a pure panic at not only the sight of a black man walking up the road, but coming to their homes, And so what do they do? Which is common nowadays too. They call law enforcement. Okay. And basically they start hunting him down. But I think about this often is that, he's doing what he's doing this just Jim Crow dance because that is what he knows to do. But he doesn't understand that that dance does not work in the rural Midwest. That's very sad, very sad. And basically, Vigo County Sheriff comes out and they start hunting him down. They hunt him down. He is chased across the Illinois state line because Vigo County and Edgar County, Illinois, only like 8 miles. He is chased across the state line. And to make a long story short, he goes to a home, asks for food and water. And any of your audience are old enough to know what the party line is about,
When I saw that, Renato, I'm like, oh my goodness. I tried to explain that concept to a Gen Z and I'm like, it didn't, it was hard. It was hard. But
I had to ask my
when
mom
you said
about it.
that that's how the word spread, that made sense to me.
That's how the word spread quick that this strange Negroes in the area be on the lookout. Okay. So this is October 12th, 1942. He's now crossed the state line to Illinois. The whole community knows, be lookout for this strange Negro. He goes to this house, asks for food and water. He's having a decent conversation with this guy, whose name is James Stickler, who happens to be the justice of the peace for Edgar County. But I believe James Stickler's wife, upon hearing her husband and James person talk, I believe she called the party line and said, "Hey, look, I need help." Because in his statement to the FBI, James Stickler said that James person was very short, very nice. He asked him where he was from. He said Tennessee. He thanked him for the food and water and started walking. But James Person did not get no more than 15, 20 steps when cars come flying down the road. James Person then runs back to James Stickler and says, "What are all these cars doing?" James Stickler says, "I don't know, but don't run." Nine men get out the car. James Person sees men with firearms. He starts running. They start shooting. James Stickler, in his statement to the FBI, says, "I saw him fall down. I saw his hat fall off. I saw his left shoe fall off. I saw him get back up, jump over the fence, run through the cornfield." That was October 12th, 1942. It is now dusk, and they can't find him. They look for him in the cornfield, can't find him. 6 weeks later, on November 26th, 1942, on Thanksgiving Day, a man is hunting for squirrels in a thicket of woods, and he sees James Person's body all shot up. Basically, his body was decomposing. And the Edgar County State's Attorney issued a, well, he didn't do much. I'll just put it that way. I won't go into detail, but the state's attorney didn't do anything. But James Person's father gets a telegram saying, "Your son's been found here dead. We will send you his effects, but we have to bury him immediately." James Person's father, Christopher Columbus Person, then calls the American Legion in Jackson, Tennessee, the Negro branch, and says, "I need help. My son's been murdered up in Illinois. Can you help me?" The man who got that letter, Percy Hardin, who ended up practicing law in Indianapolis, he writes the Department of Justice and says, "You need to investigate this." And it hits the DOG at a good time. Well, let me take that back. He writes FDR and hits FDR at a good time.
This and it hits the DOG at a good time. Well, let me
Sorry
take that
about
back.
that.
He writes FDR and hits
But
FDR at a
his
good time. This
Go
and
ahead.
hits the DOG at a good time. Well, let me
Sorry
take
about
that back.
that.
Okay. No, but it hits the at a good time because FDR is, I'm gonna use this word, but it's probably too strong of a word, is embarrassed because the Japanese are dropping propaganda to black troops, basically questioning their loyalty to the United States. Why are you all fighting against us when you can't, you have no rights? And that embarrassed FDR. So what FDR does is he opens up the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. And one of the first cases they investigate was James Person. And actually, the very first case that I found they investigated, you might know this, was Cleo Wright in Sykes, Missouri. Cleo Wright was lynched in Sykes, Missouri, maybe 8 or 9 months before James Person's. But unlike James Person's, there were no indictments, so there was no convictions in Cleo Wright's. So it's that international piece that put pressure on FDR to open up the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. They investigate. And remarkably, they indict 13 people out of Indiana, Illinois, federal
Now,
indictments.
that in and of itself, Renato, was just remarkable. And I
Yes.
kept going back to the determination and the resourcefulness of, I hate to say his name, but Christopher Columbus Person. I don't know, mama should have been in my life. But Christopher Person was just relentless about his son, like wanting to make sure that his son got justice, that he knew all the facts. And there's no doubt in my mind that it would have never gone as far as it did had it not been for his dad.
Oh no,
And
no, just
mom,
the eight, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Just the agency that Christopher Person took regarding his son's death it would not have happened without him. It would not have
Right.
happened. So they indict these 13 people. Four of them were Vigo County sheriffs, and nine of them were farmers from Illinois and Indiana. And the case goes to federal court in East St. Louis, which is why it was in the East St. Louis Public Library in the first place, those articles. So it goes to court in East St. Louis, and the men took what's called a nolo contendere. Well, the charges against the sheriffs were dismissed because they said they weren't present, which is true, but they still should have been convicted because they gave the mob the order to shoot to kill. So it ended up being determined that James Person had 60 shotgun pellets in his back and a 22 that went through his stomach. And it would have been a 22 that ended up killing him. But the charges against the sheriffs were dropped, but nine farmers took a nolo contendere plea, no contest plea. They don't even offer that in federal court anymore. It goes out as a conviction, though. They got a $200 fine. So James Person's life at that time was worth $1,800. $200 wow. a day would be about $4,000 a piece. But his life was worth $1,800. So it's a remarkable case because this is 1942. I have not found a federal case before James Person's where whites were both indicted and convicted. I know some are out there, but I haven't found any yet.
So, Renato, I know part of the article that speaks to the role of law enforcement in lynching. And that's why I mentioned the fact early on about sometimes there's a fine line between, you know, these white racist militia and law enforcement. Sometimes they look like the same people. But there had been some research done on the fact that when law enforcement is involved, the lynchers or lynch mob are more emboldened. You know, because they have been empowered to do what they're doing. So talk a bit about what it means when the sheriff opens up the jail so that the mob can get in. They didn't do it in this case, but in many cases, that's how the mob gets to these folks, is somebody from law enforcement says, yeah, let's lynch that nigga. And then they open up the jail gates. So how often did that happen? And were they, and I know there probably were cases where there were law enforcement who actually moved, like, you know, suspects for fear of their lives. And so that too is part of the history. So tell us what you found.
It kind of runs a gamut. Law enforcement was involved in a lot of ways in many lynchings. Either they were deputizing mob members, either they were part of the lynch crew themselves, either they were handing over keys to the jail. So they're involved in a lot of different ways. Now there's some instances where law enforcement were actually trying to stop a mob. You know, recent scholarship has located that as well. But, you know, more likely than not, law enforcement either did nothing, you know, were involved, in James Person's case, they were directly involved. They gave orders to shoot to kill. Mm. You know, one of the mob members asked, you know, the sheriff, said, you know, what do we do if we see him? Shoot him, you know? And when the FBI interviewed the sheriff, he lied. You know, he said he didn't say that. So law enforcement was often involved in this, you know, in many different ways. Let me go back, though. Let me also say that, you know, there is, I get this question a lot. There is no solid definition of lynching.
I wasn't going to ask that question because you had like maybe three or four different methodologies. And then because Person was shot the way he does, most people sort of in their minds think lynching is the hanging part. But this was a bit different. So, yeah, that was interesting.
Yes, so, you know, so scholars have long, even going back to Du Bois, have long debated a definition of lynching. It could be a beating, drowning, think about Emmett Till, you know, shooting, hanging, things like that. So there is no universal definition of what a lynching is. And nowadays, scholars are saying that a lynching can also be a threatened lynching, like we're going to hang you until, you know, you almost die, but let you go so you can warn other folks not to do what you just did. So it can be on the verge of death. So scholars are now saying that could be considered a lynch. Didn't have to necessarily be death. So that definition is always kind of in flux.
Would you also say that not only is that definition pretty broad, but even the perpetrators are broad? Because I know sometimes people think of a lynch mob and the gatherings that they had as they watch people like burn to death. But, you know, I consider lynching what Zimmerman did to, you know, the child in Florida. To me, that's a lynching, because that person got a death sentence without due process. And so when I think about that, that's why I said that lynching is not in the past, it's part of the future. Last year, in the African World News, there was a special, this is a special edition on lynching, or quote, suspicious deaths. And they were in Mississippi, New York, North Carolina, Alabama, Illinois. So a lot of these are up south, and they're recent. And so in different ways. And so I'm just wondering what the research is saying about connecting the, in many ways, state sanctioned murders of Black people. Just recently, last month, we had the 18-year-old Marcavius Rump, who was found murdered, dismembered, and set on fire. That's 2026. So this thing is still a part of our culture, our society, and I think people still look at it as something vicious, but maybe just a part of who we are. I don't get why there's not more outrage about it, even as late as last month, when an 18-year-old child, 18-year-old, as far as I'm concerned, is a child, is murdered. And the only way that this family can get justice is they have to look for this child themselves, and they found the remains. And so what are we doing in 2026 to raise awareness about state-sanctioned killing, no matter who does it, whether it's a mob, a white mob, or whether it's an individual who thinks they have the right to take a Black life because somebody's music is too loud?
Yep. We have got to, that's a great question. That's a great question. And I'm going to back up a little bit. I would consider George Floyd's murder a lynching. That's a lynching, you know.
Yep.
That definition, it just gives you, it gives all of us, you know, a reason to try to come up with a solid definition if we can. But no, we have to protest. We have to call our, you know, our elected people about what's going on. We have to do that, because there's no reason why these parents should have to be going out doing all this. We have to be outraged by this. Any type of collective violence like that, we need to be outraged. But I think one reason that the general society is not outraged is because it happens to Black folks, you know, for the most part, happens to Black folks, you know, and we have been deemed a problem, you know. And Du Bois said it, you know, back in his Souls of Black Folks, you know, what does it feel like to be a problem? They have made us a problem. In making us a problem, you don't care about Black life nearly as much, or if at all. So somebody gets, you know, murdered, a Black kid gets murdered, you don't look into it, you know, as much as you should. You don't investigate it as much as you should. So I think that's part of it. But we as Black people have got to do better as far as pushing our elected officials to get into this and look at that. But
Also pushing our own people to understand. I mean, some of us have internalized the fact that our lives are not worthy, and maybe they did something to provoke, and everything's going to be justified. Right. And I understand back in 1800s where Black people wouldn't be rallying around that because there's the whole terror and fear of it. But nowadays, I don't get it. I mean, if some mob came and snatched up your kid like they did Emmett Till, and you can't do a damn thing about it but watch them for fear that they might grab somebody else, that you have to be silent, that part I get. It must be just added pain and trauma to what already is happening, that you're going to have the shame and guilt of not being able to protect your loved one. But now it's really no excuse for us. And so one of the things I thought about, Renato, is like, do we have a sense of the number of lynchings? And I'm using lynching in the broadest terms that we just discussed, but we don't even have enough evidence and documentation of lynchings in the past, the traditional lynchings of hanging and being dismembered and being burned to death, and people having picnics and taking specimens for to boast about. And I say that because most, and this is what I've heard from my own family and people from the South, is like, you didn't say your loved one was lynched. Even in the case, I think, of Person, he didn't, it wasn't that he got lynched. They didn't say he was lynched. They said, I can't remember, it was inconclusive or homicide, but they didn't say lynched. So when you start to like look at the documentation, you're adding up and you're looking for lynchings. Well, they didn't count him as being lynched. So will we ever know the real number of lynchings, probably predating modern media, because now people can like record themselves like a lynching. But how do you get to a true number?
That's a great question. That's a great question. James Person's lynching is death by gunshot.
That's what it was.
But between 1882 and 1968, Tuskegee Institute said there was almost 5,000 lynchings. 72% were African Americans. Now we know that data is incorrect. It far devalues the number of Black people who were lynched. And goes back to what you were saying. They didn't count as a lynching. It couldn't have been a murder, a drowning. So we will never know the totality of the numbers. And scholars have been trying to do that for the past, 50, 60, 70 years. But we know Tuskegee numbers are not correct. They've
Well,
been
I
found
know
out.
that even when I read 100 Years of Lynching back in college, and that was in the late 60s, that even is outdated now. And I think the kind of research that's been done by the Equal Justice Institute with the Lynching Museum and all of that has tried to get more accurate numbers based on people knowing their locale and knowing what happened. So I think that's the ongoing project. But it make there's a couple of other questions that people sent me to ask you, because we talk about the trauma for the Black community. But this question said asked, what about the trauma to white people who were watching, particularly children? Because a lot of times back in the day, these were public events, and sometimes they would wait till school was out so that the kids could see. And I remember there's a piece in your article that says sometimes they hung the person low enough so when you pass, you could swing the body around as you pass. So these were active participants. And so there's a certain barbarism that's in here, a certain pathology. And so the question is there any studies on white people who endured the watching of lynching or the participation in lynching?
That's a great question. I have not come across any studies that have interviewed whites who have observed a lynching. I just haven't come across any of that. I think primarily because there was this wall of silence. They just kind of, they just buried it, didn't want to talk about it, didn't want to acknowledge that they were there, any of that kind of stuff. So I haven't come across any studies that, where whites were interviewed regarding, what they've seen at a lynching. I will tell you this, I've talked to family members of the assailants of James Person's lynching, and now we're talking about grandkids. But what they've said to me was very interesting. They all paint their relatives as just great people. I can't see my great grandfather doing something like that, so he used to hold us and, tell stories. They don't understand that, it's so if they're saying this in 2026, you can imagine what somebody who was actually present at lynching a child or otherwise, are going to say, regarding the matter, and probably paint the black person as a criminal, deserving what they got. And that's pretty much what everybody said in James Person's case. He was going around scaring white women, so deserve what he got. But I have not found, to answer your question, I've not found any scholars.
Okay, and you this is the second question is a follow-up, and it may be the same, you might have the same answer, and that is the role of white women who in many cases precipitated the attacks on black men, whether it be Emmett Till or in this case these women feeling threatened. And because in all actuality, Person did nothing illegal. I mean, he knocked on the doors. He didn't steal anything. He knocked and asked, could he have some food? And just his presence was a threat. And so it was the white women who raised the temperature. And so is there anything, that's the question, is there any research done on white women who either claim threat or claim rape as to the pathology of that?
Now, there's been a lot of research on that. There's been a lot of research on that. There's one book I'm trying to think of. I can't think of the title. But there's been a ton of research on white women and their role in basically getting black people, black men lynched. And I can't think of the name of some of the books off the top of my head, but I do know there's been a
Well,
lot of
can you
research.
talk about some of the themes that come out of there, some of the conclusive suppositions as to why that's done? I mean, many folks will say fear, but sometimes, like in the case of Person, that didn't have to, I mean, there was no immediate personal threat to the women there. And in fact, they had, sent him away from one community. So the fear wasn't as prevalent even in, well, wasn't even prevalent when so-called whistling at a white woman that got Emmett Till in trouble. So what are they saying about that? Are they saying it's just the mob mentality and the fear at that time and fear of rage from the white people in that community? What's the deal?
Well, a lot of scholarship is saying that white women are placed in a disadvantaged position from the get-go, being a woman, in a male-dominated world where men are running things, and it's almost like they are supposed to follow.
Participate, yeah,
Yes,
participate
you know what I
in
mean?
the
Right.
patriarchy,
Yep.
terrorism, yeah.
And that's what some of the scholarship is saying, has been saying for decades. They're at a disadvantaged role from the get-go. I don't know if I buy all of that, but I could see that. But these white women, in Person's case, they call in the sheriff automatically. Husbands weren't home, but Person's blackness was considered a crime. Not the fact he's just walking around, he's walking around as a black man. So they've bought into all this racist propaganda for black men. The black boogeyman, he's gonna sexually assault, he's gonna rape us. So they bought into that logic. And so when you see an unknown black man, the first thing you experience is just fear. And can you imagine seeing another human being, and the first thing you see another human being, and the first thing you feel is fear? That's what they felt. So they bought into this racist, this white supremacist logic. And they got scared and they panicked. But they're, scholarship would say they're already at a disadvantaged role based on being a woman in 1940. That
They
patriarchal
had
role.
they were powerless as well in a hierarchy of things. So I just people need to be reminded that there are lynchings and there are lynchings. Like, I wrote about the lynching with Walter Johnson on Frances McIntosh, who was lynched right downtown in 1836. And one of the things in your paper, Renato, that I guess I had not thought about it in this way, but that sometimes, and I don't know, remember exactly the percentage, that folks got lynched when they were not near family or community, which certainly was the case with McIntosh. And how significant is that?
That's huge because you catch these black lynch victims by themselves. It's easy to do it when they by themselves or maybe with one a person or so. But most lynch victims are alone, separated from their family, from friends, person, Emmett Till, and things like that. And I think that's just because primarily they are they're delinquent happen because they are alone. It's hard to do all this kind of stuff when you with a group of people. Although there's a lynching in Mary, Indiana in the 30s, it was four of them and three of them got lynched. But most of them are separated from their families as far as distance. And you caught these black folks by themselves. Much harder to do that if a person would have been with four or five other black people. But it's very important to catch them alone.
Yeah, and I think this is part of the cowardness of these mobs and the racist nature of these folks. It's like the Klan, like you can't do it unless you got a hood to hide your identity
Right.
and come in the
Oh, it's
middle
definitely.
of the night, all of that secretive stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely cowardly shooting somebody in the back as they're running away from you. I don't know if you can get any more cowardly than that.
Yeah.
But yes, all of that combined. And
Yeah.
I met with a person's family. I drove to Somerville, Tennessee a couple of years ago, and they told me, Mr. Carr, we don't know the whole story. This is before I gave an FBI report, but make sure you put our pain and suffering first. We've been dealing with this for 82 years. It is
Wow.
just hurting our family. Because most lynching scholarship focuses on the assailants. Very little focuses on the victims. So they told me put their pain and suffering first.
Yeah.
The lady I talked to, Carolyn Person, James Person, was her uncle. Said she never met him, but it was her father's brother. And she said her
Oh,
father never
wow.
talked about it. He died in 2000. His name was Ransom Person. She said the only thing he said was my brother was killed up in Illinois, and he never talked about it.
And
So.
see, we perpetuate that false narrative as if there was some kind of legitimate killing, as opposed he
Right.
got lynched.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, she said it was so painful for her father. He never talked about it. He talked about it once in 1970, she told me, and that was it.
Wow.
That trauma never goes away, even
No,
though
of course not.
it never
Yeah.
goes away.
So in the few minutes that we have left, I'm thinking about, and you already answered one part of the question, and that is how did the family feel about the research and what did they want to see out of it? But in general, what are you hoping is a takeaway for people who don't have a vested interest, like they're not related to a person? What is the intent of the research, and particularly the article about person?
Well, it's a couple of things. One, a lot of us think, maybe not us, but a lot of people think that lynchings were definitely a Southern thing. And they definitely were not, definitely were not. So we don't think about the Midwest as a spot for lynchings and mass anti-Black violence, even though a lot of race riots happened in the Midwest, East St. Louis, Chicago, and things like that.
Well, there's been lynchings in Massachusetts and New York, so this goes way up north, up south. Yeah.
So it just shows you that racial terror is not limited to the South. And something you talked about earlier, it just highlights the role of law enforcement in the justice system. Every justice system failed James Person. Edgar County Police Department, Vigo County Sheriff's Department, Edgar County State's Attorney, Indiana State Police, Illinois State Police, all these agencies did nothing. And the federal government got involved. So it
Wow.
highlights the role of law enforcement. So I
Right.
want people, most people do not understand the history of law enforcement in the United States as it pertains to black people,
Wow. Yep.
so just things like that.
So that, I think this is intriguing research, and the fact that it's still going on as late as May 2026 means that we can't bury it. We got to talk about it. We got to fortify the systems that are supposed to protect people. We're supposed to have, due process. We're supposed to have equal justice under the law. And when that doesn't happen, then we are always going to be victims. People of African descent will always be victims. I want to thank you, Renato Carr, for joining us today to talk about this subject, and particularly giving us some insight into the life and and legacy of Mr. Person, because it's fascinating, and I'm sure his family's appreciative that his life was lifted up. It wasn't buried in the annals of history, but lifted up for the world to see.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Yeah, and so if you didn't get all of this, show, you can go to the website probably in the next 12 hours, jamalarogers.com, to get past shows, but also those that have been videotaped by Zoom. That's going to be on my YouTube channel. So don't you miss it, don't feel bad. You can always go and get it back. But yeah, we are so grateful for the opportunity, really, to share guests like Renato and other topics that maybe we
We
don't get to hear.
stand
But
on the future.
this is the world we live in, and nothing is gonna happen differently unless we make it happen. This is Jamala Rogers, your host. Thank you for listening, and I will see you on the battlefield.